Angela had attempted to drown their then 6-month-old son in the backyard wading pool. 4 months later, on her first leave from the Payne Whitney Psychiatric Clinic, she tried it again. 19 years later, she was still institutionalized, most recently at a residential treatment facility in Michigan, not far from her parents' home in Wisconsin. Pavlicek still grieved for her and still hated himself for being so oblivious to her pain and madness back then. As far as Billy knew, they were still married. "You ever been out of the country?" Pavlicek asked as they cruised past the Forensic Psychiatric Center, a.k.a. the Hat Factory, on Ward's Island. "Nope," Billy said, trying to peer through the barred windows to the Thorazine-infused prisoners within. "My dad was in England a bunch of times, did a tour in Vietnam." "That's him. Plus, war doesn't count."
"Been to Puerto Rico with Carmen to see your grandmother once."
"Puerto Rico is part of the U.S., plus visiting family doesn't count."
"Then I guess I've been living in my ass for 42 years. What's your point, Big Shot? Did I ever tell you about the time I went to Amsterdam with John Jr.?"
"You went to Amsterdam?"
"4 years ago, I was invited to talk at an urban renewal conference there, and I wanted to bring him. He was 16. It's a cool city, sort of, so he says, 'I'll let you take me to Amsterdam.'"
"Let you?"
"Let you take me if you get stoned with me there. Nick Perlmutter went with his dad last year and told me they got wasted together. Says to me, 'Hey, at least you'll know who I'm getting high with.'"
"You did not do that."
"I'm sorry, you never got high?"
"With my kids?"
"Your kids are little, Billy. It's different later. It's like trying to hold back water with your hands, trust me."
"You still don't have to smoke up with them."
Pavlicek shrugged.
Feeling a little scandalized, Billy shut up.
"In any event, we got there, made a beeline to the nearest coffee bar, sat outside facing this plaza, Plots, or whatever. Junior's all showing off how he can read a pot menu like a wine list, orders us something supposedly mild. A few hits and we're both zotzed. It was fun at first. We couldn't figure out how to take our picture, holding the camera every which way, laughing, you know, stupid stoned. Finally, this Dutch lady inside the bar takes pity on us, comes out and does the honors. 2 American morons getting high in Amsterdam. Never seen that before. We're laughing our balls off for about a half hour, then the paranoia just shuts us down like blam. I mean, like a solid hour of can't talk, sitting there wondering how do we find the fucking hotel, Prinzengracht, Schminzenstrasse, where's the Anne Frank house, and are we bad half Jews if we blow it off? How do we even just, like, stand up? Hours like that, then Johnny finally turns to me, says, 'Well, this wasn't one of my better ideas, was it?' He flies home the next day. It's really a nothing city, but I'm stuck doing the panels. I felt horrible. I mean, okay, you're right. What kind of pandering asshole has to curry favor with this kid like that? But you know what? A week later, I finally come home, and I see that on his bedroom door, Johnny had taped blow-ups of all the photos of us that the Dutch lady took, and goddamn, didn't it look like we had a blast? And now when we... It always plays for a laugh when it comes up in conversation, between the pictures and the way we tell it to people. It's like after a while the two of you were like a comedy team. And you forget, I forgot, how bad it felt. I just..."
Billy heard a sudden rasp of tears in Pavlicek's voice that he had no idea how to interpret. And so he held his peace until they got where they were going. 20 strained minutes later. The Riveras, like everyone else on City Island, lived on one of the short streets branching off the sole avenue that ran like a spine for 2 miles, from the land bridge to the Long Island Sound. Their house, a run-down Victorian gingerbread, was at the tail end of Fordham Street, the lapping waves audible from every room. The family had 2 views, the Sound at a point where New York and Connecticut met underwater, and the ruins of the house directly across the way, not 100 feet opposite, behind which the body of their son Thomas was found 5 years earlier, discarded and torn. The house was now in the midst of being demolished by the new owners. The walls collapsed in a violent heap, jagged spears of lumber shooting out in all directions like an abstract expression of its own notoriety. Ray Rivera, now 60 pounds heavier than the night his son was discovered,
stood on his lawn with Billy and Pavlicek, chain-smoking and staring at the wreckage across the way. His wife, Nora, was somewhere inside their house, undoubtedly aware of the visit, but declining to come out. To Billy, most of Rivera's new obesity seemed to be in his upper body and face rather than his gut, in the multi-tiered pouches under the eyes, the softening flesh of his broad chest, and the forward slump of his thick shoulders. Billy had seen this transformation before, in parents who struggled daily with the violent death of a child. After a few years, that emotional heaviness could visually de-sex a couple, leaving them looking more like each other than if they'd lived into their 90s together. "You know, I have real mixed feelings about that shit pile coming down." Rivera coughed wetly into the side of his hammy fist, took another drag. "I keep thinking, maybe they're destroying evidence, or maybe a shred of his soul is still in there." "He's not there anymore, Ray," Pavlicek said. "I know you know that." Billy saw movement behind a second-floor window in the Rivera house. Nora up there, hours every day looking across the street. "People asked us why we didn't move away, but it would have been like abandoning him, you know?" Suddenly the window opened and Nora Rivera leaned out, red-faced, cawing. "Why didn't they move away?" Pavlicek raised a hand in greeting. "Hey, Nora." The window slammed like a gunshot. "You know, I know people, and I could have made some calls anytime I wanted. Once a guy called me. But if I wanted that Jeffrey kid dead, I would have done it myself."
"That's not you, Ray."
"I mean, do you have any idea how many times I sat on that porch with a piece of steel in my hand? I always drank my way out of it."
"Is there anything you want to ask me about Jeffrey Banyan?" Billy offered. Rivera ignored the question.
"Last year we went to the National Memory Keepers Convention. Johnny here came with us,"
nodding to Pavlicek.
"They had a bunch of workshops and seminars, and I sat in on a support group for fathers with murdered kids."
Rivera took another moist drag on his cigarette.
"And this guy, some old biker from Texas, he said he sat in on the execution of his son's murderer in Huntsville. Said it didn't make a difference, called it a letdown. But I'm not so sure that would have been the case with me."
"Ray," Pavlicek said gently, "we have to go."
"Our pastor says Jesus wants us to try and forgive, but I'll tell you, these last few years, I'm all about the God of the Jews."
They came upon Jimmy Whelan in the lobby of the apartment house where he lived and worked as the super, a run-down pre-war with a deep H-block courtyard on Fort Washington Avenue. At this hour, the food odors of three continents crept down the elevator shaft like fog. Whelan looked good for 46, a lean, sometime weightlifter with a full head of brown hair, a big nose, and the exaggerated mustache of a gunslinger, which wasn't too far off. By the time he'd retired, he'd held the record for justifiable shots fired incidents of any active police officer in the NYPD. Towards the end of his career, he was transferred to the crime scene unit, one of the least likely places where a detective could find a reason to pull his weapon. But even with that squad, he managed to get into a shootout, having wandered into a 3 a.m. bodega robbery while on a coffee run 2 blocks away from an indoor doubleheader being processed by his CSU team in the New Lots section of Brooklyn. Dressed tonight in a dagger-collared cherry leather car coat and flare-bottom jeans, he was standing in front of the geriatric twin elevators, barking at a toffee-colored tenant with vaguely Asiatic eyes and a whippet mustache, the guy shoulder-toting a duffel bag as if on shore leave.
"What are you doing?" Whelan snapped.
"Spreading the joy,"
his whiskey hoarse voice just shy of a shout.
"The joy? Are you crazy? Get your ass back upstairs."
"How are you doing, sirs?"
the guy said, turning to Billy and Pavlicek and extending his free hand.
"Esteban Appleyard."
Whelan abruptly walked away, shaking his head as if he had just about had it with this idiot. "What you got in here?" Billy asked. Appleyard opened his duffel to display mini bottles of Rihanna Rebel perfume, half pints of Alize VS cognac, and cellophane-wrapped packs of White Owl cigarillos.
"Have a cigar,"
Appleyard beamed. "I don't smoke," Billy lied.
I'll be in the car, Pavlicek muttered, wheeling so abruptly that he nearly collided with Whelan, who was steaming back from Moore Apple Yard. Where's the money?
They're gonna wire it to my bank.
When?
I don't know.
Whelan turned to Billy. This guy just won $10 million playing the lottery. Can you believe that?
For real?
Billy knew Whelan's irritation had nothing to do with envy. Taking his super's job to heart despite his run-and-gun resume, Jimmy always projected this scolding vibe toward the more obliviously self-destructive members of what he considered his flock. One of the elevators groaned open and a woman sporting an African head wrap stepped out, her arms filled with folded laundry. Appleyard dug in his duffel and pulled out a bottle of perfume.
For you, Chicky!
I don't wear that, she said sharply, as angry at him as Whelan.
Give me a kiss. You should move out of here,
rearing back from his 90-proof breath.
Everybody knows.
Looking to the lobby, now stripped of nearly all of its original 1920s furniture and mirrors, Billy was surprised to see Pavlicek still in the house, slumped over on the lone couch, his head sunk into his hands as if he were too exhausted to make it back out to the street.
You got a car? Whelan asked Appleyard. Buying one. I like that Maybach like Diddy got. A nice chocolate brown.
Can you even drive?
Drove a truck out of the poultry terminal for 14 years before I got shot that one time,
yanking down his sweater collar to show the skid mark scar at his collarbone. Whelan pulled out a set of keys, stuffed them in Appleyard's pocket.
You know my car? The Elantra? Appleyard sniffed. I wouldn't be caught dead in that.
You go upstairs and pack. You take my car and go up to my cabin in Monticello for a week. Figure out where you want to live and what you're going to do with yourself, because around here, they're going to eat you alive. The woman nodded in agreement.
No, man, Appleyard waved him off. People know me.
Exactly. Somebody comes to my door 3 days from now, says there's a smell from 5D. I don't want to find you, see some three-legged alligator tortured you for your ATM code, left you with a screwdriver in your ear.
Yeah, well.
Appleyard's duffel slipped from his grip, the perfume and cognac bottles clinking on the smooth stone floor.
I can't see that.
The African tenant finally took off, crossing the lobby on her way to the front door, Pavlicek not even raising his eyes to her as she glided past the couch, her voluminous house coat brushing his knees.
And stop handing that shit out or you won't even make it 2 days. What's wrong with you? How much you want for the cabin and the car?
Appleyard asked, peeking into the duffel for spillage.
Because I know you want something.
For a week? Whelan said, squinting at the ceiling.
$1,500. And I'm supposed to worry about everybody else taking me off, huh?
Make it $2,000 and I'll come with you.
Charge me for you to come to your own house?
You got a TV up there?
Of course. They sell groceries up there?
No, everyone crawls around eating grass.
Bars?
You stay out of bars.
Nah, I'm gonna stay right here,
handing Whelan back his keys.
This is my block.
I tell you what, Whelan said. I'll sell you the car for $12,000.
I don't think so,
Appleyard laughed, then hauled the duffel back up on his shoulder and took off down the hall to knock on doors. As they finally headed out to the street, Pavlicek falling in with them silently, Billy's cell rang. Stacy Taylor again. Billy killing this call from her, too. Collins' steakhouse was situated in the financial district on a small, cobblestoned lane lined with landmark 19th-century merchants' homes and low shebeens named after Irish poets, the whole plunked down like an antique snow globe dwarfed and surrounded by a futuristic ring of office towers. They were the first to arrive, and the publican Stephen Cunliffe, a Belfast transplant who by blood mandate loved cops and writers, brought over a tray of Middleton shots before they had even taken their seats.
"Sláinte,"
Cunliffe said, hoisting his own. Although Irish himself, Billy could live the rest of his life without hearing that particular toast again.
"Is Mr. Brown coming?"
"Redmond's got a funeral service uptown," Billy said.
"And the lovely Miss Asaph Doyle?"
"As per usual, she'll be coming when she comes." Which was 20 minutes later, swooping to the table like a rush breath, her enormous dark eyes beneath blue-black hair, wet and combed straight back as if she had just come from a workout,
and wearing, as always, her trademark hippie coat, calf-skin shearling trimmed with vaguely Tibetan embroidery and frogged buttons.
"Where's mine?" Yasmin said, looking at the empty glasses.
Cunliffe snapped his fingers and a fresh round appeared as if the waiter had it behind his back all along.
"My job this week?" shrugging off her coat. "I had a girl in the dorms from India, lost her virginity to some douchebag in the village. The guy made a tape, and now he's threatening to send it to her parents if she stops putting out. So I had to go up to his skank-ass crib and scare the piss out of him, like, call out the dogs of war, right? Oh, and today, they had me investigating a missing sweater. Anyways, basaha."
Draining her shot. Then, "So, Billy, you caught the Banyan job?"
4 in the morning.
"Penn Station, a real clusterfuck, right? Any leads?"
"At this point, ask Midtown South. I'm just the night porter."
"You ever see that movie? I almost asked for my money back."
"What movie?" Whelan said.
"Anyway, here's to Banyan," hoisting her second glass. "When bad things happen to bad people. Hear, hear."
"First Tomasi, then Banyan," she said. "It's like justice started peeking under the blinds."
"When people say hear, hear like that," Whelan said, "do they mean hear, like to hear something, or like, hey, over here?"
"Whoa, wait," Billy held up his hand.
"Brian Tomasi, what happened to him?"
"Are you serious?"
Whelan said. "Do you not read the papers?
Just say.
You know that stretch of Pelham Parkway by Bronx House where him and his crew chased Yusuf Khan in front of the cab?"
"Yeah, and?"
"Take 2 giant and 1 umbrella steps south of there, Tomasi, 2 a.m. in the morning, tweaking like a beacon, steps off the curb and becomes one with the 12 bus.
"When was this?"
"Last month."
"Just like that?"
"Just like that."
Laughing, Billy nodded to Whelan. "You push him?"
"I would have, you better believe that."
Billy remembered the day after it happened, Whelan telling him that when the panic-stricken Khan, running blindly across the 4-lane northbound parkway, had been struck by a muscle car doing 65, the sound of the impact had been loud enough to set off car alarms for blocks around.
"Hey, what's the last thing that passed through Tomasi's mind after he got creamed by that bus?"
Yasmin asked.
"His ass," Pavlicek grunted, his first word since they had all sat down. "Christ, if you're gonna tell stupid fucking jokes." Once again, Billy noticed that he seemed on the verge of tears. "You okay, big guy?"
"Me?"
Pavlicek brightened a shade too fast.
"You know what I was doing today when I called you? Going through one of my buildings with an exorcist. I got a Chinese contractor to gut the place. His people go in, they come right back out 15 minutes later saying it's haunted. No way they're going back in. So I went and hired an exorcist."
"The Chinese are the worst," Yasmin said. "They're so superstitious."
"You ever see a Chinaman commit suicide?" Whelan added. "They don't believe in quick and painless."
"Where'd you get the exorcist?" Billy asked.
"This lady runs a smoke shop near my house. She's some kind of Wiccan with a sideline in ghost-busting."
"She's for real?"
"She knows what's expected of her, puts on a good show. Comes with flashlights, humidifiers, wind chimes, Enya tapes."
"Who are you gonna call?"
"Only thing is, they have their gods and we have ours."
"We have gods?" They waited for Pavlicek to continue, but he seemed to have lost interest in his own story. "So, did it work or not?" Billy asked.
"What?"
"The exorcism."
"It's ongoing,"
Pavlicek said, looking off.
"So, Billy, how's your family?"
Yasmin, catching his eye, let it be, then downing her third or maybe fourth shot.
"Good, you know, I mean, my father's not getting any better, but
my dad once tried to talk me into letting him come to live with us. I had his ass in a home before he got the first sentence out."
"You're all heart there, Yazzie," Whelan said.
"What do you mean I'm all heart? The guy was a psycho. He used to get drunk and burn us with cigarettes."
"I got a heart. Why do you always want to make me feel so bad?"
"Yasmin, I'm kidding."
"No, you're not,"
she slurred. Then after a too long beat,
"Fucking Whelan, you always make me feel bad. What did I ever do to you?"
She then proceeded to descend into one of her legendary sulks, Billy knowing from experience that there was a good chance they wouldn't hear from her for the rest of the evening. Yasmin was the only woman Billy knew who could match his wife mood swing for mood swing. They even looked alike, although Yasmin's coloration came from her Syrian father and Turkish mother, which had made being constantly addressed as mami and automatically spoken to in Spanish out on the street agitating enough for her to more than once ask for a transfer to a more upscale precinct. But she was a fierce friend, dressing down his first wife in the street directly in front of the demonstrators who had driven her to leave him after his shooting. Well, that wasn't such a hot idea. Then, years later, when Carmen was going through a particularly black spell, taking in their kids for an entire summer until his wife was back on her feet. So Billy would put up with any kind of stormy behavior that came his way, but with Yasmin now brooding in her tent, and Pavlicek halfway to a morose coma of his own, the table suddenly had the energy of a brownout.
"Can I tell you something?" Billy began, trying to plug the gap. "You talk about exorcisms. I never told this to anybody before because it embarrassed me, but about 6 months into trying to nail Curtis Taft, Carmen convinced me to consult a psychic."
"Get out,"
Whelan stepping in like a straight man.
"Some old Italian lady up in Brewster. I mean, I was so desperate at that point. So I call her up, go to her house. I swear she looked just like Casey Stengel. Hey, how you doing? Thanks for seeing me." And I walk into the living room. The walls are covered with appreciation letters from different police departments around the country. Maybe a few from Canada, another from some town in Germany. It was pretty impressive until you go up close and read one. "It has come to my attention that you might possibly have been of some assistance in the as-yet-unsolved homicide death of fill-in-the-blank. Thank you for your time and enthusiasm. Sincerely, Elmo Butkus, Chief of Police, French Kiss, Idaho." But whatever, I'm there. I sit on the couch, she's in a rocking chair. I was told to bring some objects belonging to the Vicks. So I hand over a barrette belonging to the 4-year-old, Drina Bailey, Memory Williams' iPod, and Tanya Howard's Bible. I tell her what we think happened. Taft coming in there around sunrise, 3 shots and just walking out, going home, getting back in bed with his still-asleep girlfriend. She says to me, "Okay, here's how it works. I'm going to sit here and think about what you just told me, and I'm going to get a little worked up, and I'll say things, a word, a phrase, and you write everything down, whatever I say." And then she says, "Now, the things I'll be saying, I don't know what any of it means. They're like pieces of a puzzle that you gotta put together, okay? You're the detective, not me, okay?" I say, "Okay." "And oh, wait," she says. "By the way, I never charge cops for helping them. That's my civic duty. All I ask in return is a letter from you on your police department stationery thanking me for my assistance." I say, "Yeah, sure, no problem. Let's go, let's go." And then she starts rocking in the chair, rubbing Drina's barrette, and lets it rip. 4 years old, that poor little kid, she never had a chance, she'll never see her mother again or play jump rope. That evil cocksucker, that fucking butter! I almost jumped out the window, she shouted it so loud, but I write down, "butter." Then she's off again. "What kind of cold-blooded scumbag would take the life of running water?" Okay, writing it down, running water, I mean, everything in the world is near running water, a river, a sink, a sewer. I mean, are you serious? Then she starts going on about Memory. 14-year-old girl, her whole fucking life in front of her, this vicious pig, this miserable piece of shit, this... Tires! Okay, tires. He snuffs the life out of 3 young ladies, and then what does he do? He goes home and crawls back in bed with his new girlfriend like he just got up to take a piss. And can you imagine what a piece of work that stupid bitch... Broken toilet! And I swear on my children, when she said that broken toilet, I just about pissed myself. "Yeah?" Whelan, apparently his only listener. "Listen to me," Billy said, leaning forward. "The bodies were discovered by Tanya Howard's new boyfriend when he came to the house about 5-6 hours later, and by the time we got there, rigor was going pretty good. We found Memory and Tanya in the living room, and we thought that was it. But when I opened the bathroom door..." Billy wiped his dry mouth. "See, when Taft lived with Tanya, whenever he would discipline the little one, he'd always take her into the bathroom. And that's where he took her to shoot her that morning. And after he shot her, he stuck her head and shoulders in the toilet. Like I said, rigor had set in and we couldn't get her out, so we had to use a sledgehammer to shatter the porcelain. So, broken toilet, the lady said. Don't ask me how." "Then what happened?" "I brought her back to the projects and let her into the apartment, see if she could maybe pick something up in the air."
"Did she?"
"Nope."
"What did she say when she saw the broken toilet?"
"Just nodded, like, I told you so."
"She got you on the running water, too," Whelan said, "if you want to be technical about it."
"That too, I guess."
"You write her that letter?"
"I'm working on it."
"The thing about the younger brother,"
Pavlicek suddenly said, addressing his clasped hands,
"the one who went away for it?
Truly stupid people are the toughest to interview because they can't tell when you've talked them into a corner. Forensic says he was killed with a golf club, Eugene. Is there a golf club in the house? I don't know. Well, we found one. Okay. We found your fingerprints on it. Okay. So how could you not know there was a golf club in the house? I don't know. Do you like to play golf? No. So then, once again, I have to ask, how'd your fingerprints come to be on the shaft? I don't know.
Pavlicek took a breath, his gaze going from his hands to his untouched shot glass.
I remember, I tried to get Jeffrey's goat, so I asked him, it can't be easy living with a retard for a brother. You know what he says to me? You should try it.
He reached for his Middletons, threw it back.
A real sweetheart, he muttered,
then shut himself down, not once in his story having raised his eyes to his friend's, leaving Billy to wonder whether maybe Banyan's murder had him deeply crashing, like a postpartum Ahab if the author had allowed him to kill the whale and go home to his family.
Fuck you with your I'm all heart,
Yasmin bawled, suddenly deeply drunk and in tears.
Why do you always have to make me feel so bad?
Before Whelan could respond, she tilted into Billy, slurred in his ear.
Sometimes I can still taste you.
Then lowered her forehead to the table and went to sleep.
I think for Jeffrey, Pavlicek said to no one, Thomas Rivera, his brother Eugene, the whole thing was like snapping a tablecloth.
Then thickly,
if anybody had it coming, right?
Billy and Whelan looked at each other blankly before raising their eyes to the waiter, who had finally come by to pass out menus and announce the specials. Billy's first run of the night didn't come in until just before dawn, an assault at a flower shop on a beat-up stretch of Upper Broadway, where Harlem became Hamilton Heights, the roughness of the neighborhood offset by its heart-stoppingly abrupt view of the Hudson River, which seemed to leap up to meet the cresting avenue. Given the limbo hour, Billy's partner of choice was Roger Mayo, a hollow-eyed, scoop-chested chain smoker in his eighth year on night watch, a borderline mute, a mystery, no one in the squad having any idea where he came from or where he went afterward. But Mayo was also a natural nocturnal, someone Billy could count on not to fall face first into the lap of a suspect halfway through an interview at 6 in the morning, which was not nothing. Wading to the sidewalk through double and triple parked cruisers, they passed the open back doors of an ambulance and saw a young, chunky Latina sitting inside, a sepia necklace of fingerprints around her throat. How's she doing? Mayo asked an EMT. She's pissed. Leaving Mayo to take her statement, Billy headed to the scene of the crime, the florist shop, a cramped, ramshackle affair with wind-riddled, rotten wooden moldings around the door frame and the sole display window. The low-ceiling selling floor was covered with cracked linoleum, and the near-empty flower refrigerator was overhung by a roughly built half-loft, the squeak and groan of shifting feet up there nearly drowning out the soft jazz playing somewhere behind a battery of poinsettias and greeting card spin racks down below. Climbing a short flight of raw pine stairs, Billy found himself in a cell-like three-walled bedroom, cops and medics obscuring his view of the perp, Wallace Oliver. The guy was a frail, bare-chested 70-year-old with a pharaonic goatee, wheezing asthmatically as he sat slumped on the side of a narrow bed. The towel draped around his neck made him look like a geriatric boxer. As an EMT inserted a spirometer in Oliver's mouth to gauge his lung capacity, Billy took inventory of his surroundings. In one corner, a gold saxophone perched upright in its stand. In another stood a spindly desk, its blotter covered with a scatter of prescription bottles, a jar of olive oil, an ankh, a crucifix, and a Star of David. Scotch taped to the walls were two photographs of Oliver as a younger man, one of him on stage with Rashan Roland Kirk, the other of him performing in Sun Ra's orchestra. Billy made his way through the milling uniforms to the bed. You want to tell me what happened?
I already said all that.
Oliver reared back to peer up at him. Just one more time.
She came in once, like around Valentine's Day,
pausing to take a hit of Primatine Mist.
Says she was looking to buy a plant for her mother. Young girl. Looked around, didn't buy nothing, though. Walked out, then came back an hour later. Asked if I needed any help in here, and to tell you the truth, I just barely support myself with this, you know? So she leaves again, and then comes back a third time that night. Knocks on the door right as I'm turning out the lights. Steps inside, drops to her knees, puts me in her mouth, says, Daddy, you let me live up there, you can have me any time you want. Next thing I know, I'm a man again. But she's Satan, and everything in my life's all fucked up. I had a wife, was a school teacher, a nice crib. Moved out on them both to be up here, under a 7-foot ceiling with her. I can't even straighten my back no more, and I tell you, I will put up with a lot of meanness just to have a hard dick again, but the thing she said to me tonight...
Oliver bowed his head, kneaded his waxy amber fingers.
I have never been hurt by words like that in my life.
Leaving the scene an hour later, the rising sun accentuating the emptiness of the street, Billy heard his cell go off, Stacy Taylor again. This time a text. I know you are screening my calls, don't. Milton Ramos. I'm not even going to ask you who threw the shot because I know you didn't see, right? Milton was talking to the head-bandaged Shakespeare Avenue banger, who was sitting up on his wheel-locked gurney in the trauma room of the St. Anne's ER. Where my clothes at? The victim ducking and weaving in an effort to look past Milton, standing less than a foot away from him in the curtained-off space. Call the damn nurse. Milton gave it a beat, watching dispassionately as the traumatized tissue around Carlos Hernandez's bullet-creased temple finally began to balloon in earnest, forcing the thick gauze dressing to slowly rise like a bloody souffle. You know what? He finally said. Don't tell me. Take care of it yourself, or at least let him get another crack at you and finish what he started. Because God's truth? Milton shut his notepad. I don't give a shit. Yeah, see? You're going psychological on me. Really? I'm not. I mean this from the bottom of my heart, soldier boy. I don't give a shit. Just try not to let it go down near a playground or on a basketball court. That's all I ask. Milton never saw the point of the detective squad getting involved in a gang shooting so early in the game like this, knowing that the 4-6 street intel unit on a first-name basis with every young Morlock out there had probably already hauled in their informants. By this afternoon, they would be not only smart-bombing the streets looking for the shooter, but scarecrowing the two beefing crews, Shakespeare overall and Creston on top, from any planned retaliation and or re-retaliation. The fact of the matter was, only 2 hours after getting creased, Carlos here was already old news. The only thing anybody cared about right now was minimizing the inevitable mayhem to come. I'll tell you what, Milton said, leaning in and putting a hand on Carlos's bare knee. Give me a name, and you get one free get-out-of-jail card on me. I ain't in jail. Not today. You like putting your hand there? I'd rather put it around your throat. Milton turned to leave. You're supposed to give me your card, Carlos said. I would, but I'm running kind of low. Psychology, my balls. Coming back out into the main reception area, Milton walked past the Latina nurse manning the triage desk and up the center aisle of the waiting area, the benches eerily silent despite a full house. Reaching for the wall-mounted remote button that opened the door to the street, he hesitated, abruptly overcome with a powerful sense of having forgotten something important, the sensation like waking from an intense dream and trying to remember the fading details. He patted himself down, sidearm, notepad, wallet, keys all there, then turned and started to retrace his steps. Walking back past the triage station, getting as far as the door to the trauma room before stopping in his tracks and once again reversing his steps, this time coming back at an angle so that he could take a good look at that nurse without her noticing. Standing in the near shadows, he stared at her, then stared some more. only snapping out of it when he felt her starting to sense his presence, at which point he put his head down and took off, not looking up until he was back out on the street, the sudden sunlight adding to his hyped sense of disorientation. It wasn't until a few hours later, still in a daze as he typed up the fives on Carlos Hernandez, that he belatedly registered the name tag that had been affixed to her whites, Milton reaching for a pad and writing it down in a chittery hand. C. Graves. Wanting to be alone with this, he slipped into the windowless bunk room, ignoring the two detectives lying belly up and near lifeless in opposite corners of the fetid cell. He perched himself on the edge of an unmade bed and tried to think it through. C. Graves. The C he got. The Graves, he assumed, was her husband. Carmen Graves, he said, trying it on for size. So, married, moved on, a few kids most likely, and a career. Moved on. It was enough to snatch your breath. Chapter 3. Stepping into the house at 8 a.m, Billy came across his father and his two sons seated at the dining table eating Eggos. Billy Sr. in his pajamas, the boys as usual in full enduring freedom gear from dog tags to child-sized paratrooper boots. See, at the college, the students, they took over two buildings, one by the blacks, you know, the Afro-Americans, the other the white radicals, the suburbans we called them, his father said. I don't think they trusted each other, or at least the blacks didn't trust the whites. And Charlie Weiss, my boss in the TPF, after 2 days standing around waiting for the go-ahead, he finally gets the bullhorn, says, you have 15 minutes to vacate the building, or we're coming in after you. Dad, Billy said. Now, the Afro-Americans, they've been around the block a little more, and they know we mean what we say, so after a little trash talk from the classroom windows, they pretty much come right out. But the suburbans, they never had any dealings with the police before, so it's all a big adventure for them. Come and get us, pigs. Pigs? Carlos looked up from his waffle. Dad. And whenever we had to go in someplace, Charlie Weiss always put me in the first wave. Send in the big guy, he used to say. Riots, blackouts, demonstrations, send in the big guy. The big guy, Declan whispered, his face shining. And so we went in, and we went in swinging. It was ugly, and some of us were sick about it after, but we cracked some heads that day, Dad. Some of those kids were crying and begging us to stop. But you get to this place in yourself, you're so pent up with all the damn waiting, your heart's pumping so hard. Hey, guys, I put one kid down who tried to snatch my radio, rammed him in the ribs with my baton like they taught us. It hurts like hell. Let me tell you, he's lying on the ground, looks up at me, says, Mr. Graves, stop, please stop. I take a good look at this kid, you gotta be kidding me. Turns out he was the son of the people who we bought our house from when we moved out to the island. Nice couple, nice kid too. Last time I'd seen him was about 4 years earlier. He must have been 14, 15, but we recognized each other that day. We surely did. Did you feel bad, Grandpa? Declan again, the story a little over Carlos's head. Yeah, I did. I started yelling at him. What the hell did you grab my radio for? He says, I don't know, I don't know. I get him up, march him out of the building, take him around the corner to Amsterdam Avenue, and I tell him to go over to the St. Luke's ER, just get lost. My mom works at the ER, Carlos said brightly. I tried to tell myself that these kids had it coming, that they were trying to bring us down as a great nation, but yeah, I felt bad. That day I felt bad. Knowing the worst was over, Billy finally retreated into his coffee, marveling, as always when he heard this story, that when his father finally retired 20 years after those bloody sit-ins, his first job as a civilian was director of student safety at the same university. Anyways, Billy Sr. rising, I have to go pick up your grandmother at the bank. Declan looked to Billy, then back to his grandfather. Grandpa, he said not unkindly, Grandma's dead. Billy Sr. stopped at the door, turned to the table. That's not a very nice thing to say, Declan. Billy watched his father go out to the driveway and get in the keyless sedan, knowing he'd sit there until he forgot why he was sitting there, then come back inside. Up in the bedroom, Billy stashed his Glock, stripped down to his boxers, and fell into bed. Fighting off sleep, he stared at the ceiling until he could hear Millie's muffler-shot old beater coming down the street, signaling the start of her workday, which consisted of impersonating a housekeeper and, more importantly, watching daytime TV with his father. She would sit as close to Billy Sr. as she could without jumping on his lap, while constantly touching his arm and commenting on the screen action, all in an effort to keep him in the here and now, which was becoming an increasingly demanding job. In the way of these things, Billy's father had become his child, and he was determined to parent him in the manner in which he had been parented himself, with patience, amusement when he could manage it, and an infinite tolerance for the weakness of his mind. Growing up, Billy's mother had been just his mother, doing her duty as required, not exactly indifferent to him, but more focused on raising and training his sisters, 2 out of 3 children, in her eyes, job enough. As a father, Billy Sr. had been low-key but there, not much more demonstrative than his wife, but a powerfully comforting presence in his son's life nonetheless. When he was home all the way, a skill Billy had yet to master with his own family, and no fool when it came to wading through his son's alibis regarding everything from flunking Spanish and biology to adolescent beer benders to a brawl in a White Castle parking lot. He rarely punished, and in a neighborhood where half the parents seemed to treat their screw-up sons like piñatas, never with his hands. But most important to Billy, his father attended all his football games, from peewee and sandlot through varsity, without ever once shouting red-faced from the sidelines or criticizing his son's play. In the Nassau County Youth League, when Billy had quarterbacked his team to a 3-0 mid-season mark only to have his coach replace him with his own athletically inferior son, he remembered his father that Saturday morning trying to reason with the guy. But when he realized that the conversation was futile, he just shrugged and walked away, his eyes shining on the edge of tears. At Hofstra, which Billy attended for 2 years on a football scholarship, his father continued to show up in the stands, making it to the majority of the Pride's away games, including overnight trips to Orono, Maine and Burlington, Vermont, until it all came to an end in the spring of his sophomore year, when Billy was busted for selling weed in the dorms. His father used whatever connection he had with the Hempstead PD to prevent Billy from being formally arrested, but he made no effort to intervene when Hofstra booted him off the campus. And when Billy came home the day of his expulsion, crushed and too ashamed to ask for his parents' forgiveness, his father, deciding that his kid's self-laceration was punishment enough, simply asked him what he intended to do with his life. When Billy couldn't come up with an answer, either that first night or the next, then and only then did he suggest the police academy. When Billy came back downstairs at 3 in the afternoon, he was surprised to find Carmen's younger brother, Victor Acosta, and Victor's husband, Richard Kubin, standing together in a corner of the kitchen. Only 2 years younger than his sister, Victor looked barely old enough to vote, an effect, Billy thought, that had less to do with his short stature or his absurdly buffed physique than with his permanent expression of readiness. Wide, alert eyes beneath arched, nearly triangular brows, lips slightly parted, making him appear as if he were perpetually attempting to pick up a distant voice bearing important news. "Hey, what's up?" Billy mumbled, embarrassed to still be in his pajamas. "Hey," Victor said flatly, shaking his hand without meeting his eyes. "You all right?" Billy asked, his brother-in-law coming off uncharacteristically grim, a photo negative of himself. "Fine." "Hey, how are you?" Billy extending his hand now to Richard, older, less eager-eyed, an easygoing enough guy, no gym for him, who tended to fade into the background when it came to Victor's family. "I'm good." Richard saying it like he wanted to leave but didn't want to offend anyone. "Where's Carmen?"
"Here."
A third flatliner heard from his wife standing behind his back in the opposite corner of the room, her arms crossed over her chest, her eyes fixed on the floor. "What happened?"
"Nothing,"
Carmen said without looking up.
"Nothing?"
Victor said sharply. "What happened?" Billy addressing the men now.
"We're adopting," Victor said. "That's all."
Carmen exhaled through her nose, studied the tile work.
We just came by to share the good news, Richard added, his voice so even-keeled that Billy couldn't tell if he was being sarcastic. No, I'm happy for you, Carmen said, her gaze shifting to the backyard. I am. Billy followed the men out to their ancient Range Rover in the driveway. So, wow, adopting, he scrambled. Where from?
Brazil, Victor said.
Brazil, huh? Boy, girl?
One of each.
Twins? Can't break up a set, Richard said, unlocking the driver's side door. My husband. Billy had never thought of himself as having a problem with gay marriage, but he still couldn't quite wrap his head around another man uttering those two words. Did you tell your sister it's two?
I would have, Victor said, but I was afraid her heart couldn't handle the joy.
Anyways, that's terrific, really great, Billy said, then added by way of apology, you want us to throw you a baby shower or something? At least that got them smiling. When he returned to the house, Carmen was still standing wedged into her corner of the kitchen. The hell's wrong with you?
Heather has two daddies, she muttered, looking away.
I don't get it. Your brother comes over with such big news, you couldn't even give him a hug or something?
Guess not, she said defiantly, but starting to tear up a little.
Just tell me what's going on.
Why does something always have to be going on with you?
She snapped, then walked out of the kitchen, up the stairs, and into the bedroom, closing the door behind her. And that's where they left it. That's where they always left it when it came to Victor and, if he thought about it, so much else. At 5 in the evening, Billy walked into Brown's family funeral home on Adam Clayton Powell Boulevard. The chapel, a glorified living room, fluorescently lit and lined with folding chairs, was standing room only and awaft in dope smoke. A 22-year-old banger tagged High Life, who had been shot dead in retaliation for an earlier retaliation, lay in his coffin in a front corner of the chapel facing his people, most of whom were wearing oversized Rest in Peace t-shirts, silkscreened with a photo of High Life sitting on a stoop. A second laminated RIP snapshot on a bead chain hung off their necks like a backstage pass. Walking down the room-length particle board partition that divided the chapel from a line of office cubicles, Billy passed Redmond's elderly father in the first cubicle, Redmond Sr. leaning back in his chair playing computer poker. In the second cubicle, Redmond's 23-year-old fifth wife, Nola, was lying on a daybed reading a book in her Cote d'Ivoirean accent to Redmond's seventh or eighth son, Rafer, a toddler with a gastrointestinal feeding tube inserted into his stomach. And then finally, in the last cubicle, was the man himself. All 6'5" of him, hunched over his desk slurping lo mein from a takeout carton, the spindly wire bookcase behind his back filled with unclaimed cremains in cardboard urns going back to the 1990s.
There he is, Redmond said, extending an absurdly long-fingered hand, but remaining in his chair due to the bullet that had drilled him through both hips 5 years earlier.
Christ, Billy said, waving away the chronic in the air.
They pay like everybody else. You ever hear of secondhand smoke? That's just a story they tell you.
A conspiracy, you mean?
You said it, not me.
Like seatbelts?
Government can't tell me to buckle up. I break some bones, that's my problem.
Don't tread on me. A toddler wearing a High Life t-shirt down to her sneakers wandered in, then wandered back out unattended.
How was dinner last night?
Not to be funny, Billy said, but it was like a funeral.
Not over Banyan, I hope. You all should have been river dancing up and down the block.
What can I say? The whole thing was just off.
I heard he was exsanguinated.
Never seen anything like it. Apparently he just bled out in mid-flight, came down like a shop sign.
Exsanguinated makes my job easier.
Not mine. I had me a blood trail long as a Nantucket sleigh ride. An elderly woman, also in a High Life tee, wandered the hall while coughing up her lungs. They both watched as she pulled back a heavy curtain drawn across the end of the corridor and found herself staring at a legless body lying on a prep table like a 300-pound mound of pancake batter, a 9-inch steel syringe jammed into the jawbone through the side of the gape-locked mouth.
"Bathroom's near the front," Redmond said. "The other way."
"Oh."
She turned and wandered off without looking at them.
"Got to get a door put up," Redmond said, resuming his dinner.
Rafer, now in a wheeled Elmo activity baby walker, came flying into his father's cubicle and had to be intercepted before he crashed into the cremains stand.
"Slow your roll there, little man," Redmond said, wincing from the sudden movement.
It pained Billy to see him so fragile. Back in the early days, Redmond had once saved his life by catching him one-handed after he fell from a corroded fifth-floor fire escape while they were trying to hit a dope apartment through a bedroom window. Redmond, coming up behind him, had been one story below, and he had snagged one of Billy's arms on his way down and held him like that, Billy's feet pinwheeling 40 feet above the sidewalk until he could grab onto something with his other hand. The memory of that aborted plummet could still make him shoot up in bed at 4 in the morning.
"Is it getting any better?" Billy asked, nodding to Rafer and unconsciously touching his own gut.
"No."
Redmond had never been one to countenance blather, so Billy was at a loss for something else to say on the subject.
"See that shine-head nigger in there?"
Redmond pointed out a trimly built, middle-aged man seated in the chapel sporting a bow tie and an inexpensive but impeccable white suit, his shaved scalp gleaming under the cheap chandelier as if turtle-waxed.
"Antoine Davis Bay, that's the eagle that got Sweet Pea Harris out from under the rock."
"I fought the law and the law lost," Billy said, bracing for another Sweet Pea diatribe.
"You know I saw him last week, Harris. Came right in here for a friend's funeral. Had the gall to come up to me at my desk and ask me how I've been. You believe that? Detective Brown, that leg still hurting you?"
Redmond rearing back from his dinner in disgust.
"He's been locked up a few times since killing Salam, but I heard the last time he was smart enough to claim he had a drug problem. Avoided jail for rehab, although some people would say sitting in a group circle 8 hours a day and getting yelled at by every idiot and their cousin is worse than 6 months on a prison barge."
In Billy's estimation, Redmond, for all his unrelenting focus on bringing Sweet Pea Harris to justice, was less obsessed with his homicidally peevish white than he was with the victim, Salam Pridgen. Like Redmond himself way back when, Salam had been a 15-year-old high school phenom, already being courted by college scouts, a too-skinny kid with cheetah speed who, as Redmond would tell anyone who would listen, owned the most explosive first step to the basket he'd ever seen. A detective in Harlem at the time of the murder 8 years earlier, Redmond had been watching the boy play since 9th grade, for Rice, for the Gauchos, and even now and then in pickup games anywhere from Marcus Garvey Park to some random one-hoop half-court attached to the ass end of an elementary school. Redmond had no trouble talking about these things to one and all, including the mute bodies he'd daily prepped for homecoming, but only Billy and a few others knew that in addition to his interest in the kid, he had been sweet on Salam's mother. In between wives at that time of his life, Redmond had struck up a casual friendship with her while going to her son's games. For a while, it looked like the friendship would lead to something more. But then her son's death turned her from a smart and vigorous woman with an appetite for the world into a dead-eyed stutterer who took forever to turn to the sound of her own name.
"You rep this piece of shit, too?"
Redmond grunted to Antoine Davis Bay, who had materialized in the doorway of the cubicle.
"Black and poor," Davis Bay said, winking at Billy. "Black and poor, huh? That's an $8,000 casket, and his people paid in cash." "You're up, you're down. See how they're doing 6 months from now."
Tossing Billy a second wink, as if getting Redmond's goat was everyone's idea of fun.
"You know what they call 400 lawyers chained up and thrown into a volcano?"
Redmond said.
"Hey, guys," Billy said.
"And let me just ask," the lawyer checking the time on his oversized watch, "that $8,000, whose pocket is it in now?" "How about I take that bow tie, twist it around your neck a few times, let go and see if you spin around the room?"
"Oh, for Christ's sake," Billy said, "you're like my kids."
He started,
Bay winking at him one last time and then heading out. Watching him go, Billy looked toward the chapel and saw one of the eulogizers take the pulpit, 3 gold teeth and a blue giant's cap.
"High life, one thing about high life, he had jokes, man. He always had jokes, like he was always complaining how his teeth was cold, right?"
"Fucking Sweet Pea," Redmond said,
offering a strand of lo mein to his G-tube toddler.
I keep waiting for someone to cap his ass.
He's still living in the neighborhood?
122 West 118th, third floor rear, but I hear he spends most of his time with his quote-unquote fiancé up in the Bronx.
Well, if the Bronx is good at one thing, it's hurting people, Billy said. He'll get his. Billy's cell rang halfway between the funeral home and his car. I got your shield here, Yasmin's husband, Dennis Doyle, said. It was under our bed. You must have dropped it last night when you brought her home. You want to come get it? Before answering, Billy took a second to minutely analyze every dip and rise in Dennis's voice, searching, as always, for the slightest hint of anger. Hello? Dennis said. There was no edge that Billy could detect. There never was, and it drove him crazy. I'll come right now.
Sometimes I can still taste you.
Yasmin's last words to him in the steakhouse, and then whispered again into his ear right before she passed out for good, her arms around his neck as he lowered her fully clothed into bed. She had been way too drunk to drive after last night's catastrophe of a reunion, and with Dennis stuck working 4 to midnights as a robbery sergeant in the 4-6, Billy took it upon himself to drive her home, half carry her up to the apartment, and lay her out for the night, completely on the up and up as if Dennis had been watching on a hidden monitor. All three had known each other since their academy days when, unwittingly, both Dennis and Billy were going out with her. Dennis was in love. Billy was not. It went on for 5 months like that, both boys in the dark, until New Year's Eve 1994, when Yasmin had walked into Gordon's, cop bar near the academy, and both he and Dennis simultaneously moved to her. Billy got it instantly, the whole picture, and quickly, quietly, stepped back, letting Dennis obliviously go forward into her arms, Yasmin's sad and knowing eyes staring into his over Dennis's shoulder. And that was the end of that. No hard feelings, it was fun, you deserve the best. Dennis proposed to her at the bar that night when they were both blasted, the barmaid sailing unsteadily about the dim, damp room with plastic crates of free beer. At first she said no, said, who the fuck proposes to any kind of respectable girl at some shit-face after-hours cop bar at 5 in the morning? Dennis felt so bad about his terrible timing that he started to cry, and it was those idiotic tears, to Billy's astonishment, that did it. Okay, Yasmin finally said while stroking Dennis's hair. Sure, let's get married. Billy saw the whole thing from the short end of the bar, and he thought it was the most pathetic proposal he'd ever witnessed. Dennis never even got off his stool. He thought it wouldn't last a year, but it was going on 20 and counting. 2 girls, a 3-bedroom terraced co-op overlooking the Hudson in Riverdale, and a summer place upstate in Greenwood Lake. So, how's she feeling? Billy asked Dennis, sitting across from him in the living room.
You're looking at it, Dennis answered, tilting his chin toward the closed bedroom door at the end of the hall.
Yasmin's shucked-off Tibetan hippie coat still lying in front of the door like a shaggy guard dog 18 hours after Billy had carried her inside.
So listen, Dennis said, tilting forward from the edge of his couch. I'm sorry about last night, and I thank you for bringing her home, but help me out here. What the hell happened?
Hey, all I can tell you is that she was two-fisted throwing them back from the door on in. I don't know, maybe the news about Banyan got her all agitated about Cortez again.
Christ, I hope not. I swear to you, living with her when she's on a Cortez tear, it's like a reign of terror around here, yelling at the kids, at me. First she can't go to sleep, then she can't wake up, first she can't eat, then she can't stop. I try to get her to smoke a little weed, but even that doesn't help.
And she's drinking like this now?
She's been going through a patch.
What's a patch?
2 months, maybe?
Every night? Dennis opened his hands and closed them. That's not a patch, that's 40 acres and a mule.
I'm talking to some people about it, he said.
But she's off Cortez?
Yasmin's white, Eric Cortez, had been, and as far as Billy knew, still was, a real honey, a fully grown man who 5 years earlier had plunged a knife into the heart of 13-year-old Raymond Del Pino, ostensibly for talking to Cortez's 14-year-old girlfriend in the junior high school cafeteria.
That alone would have been horrific enough, but Cortez had also called his young Vic 24 hours before the deed just to tell him what he was going to do. Yasmin's squad quickly learned about the call and the caller from the victim's friends, and in order to start building their no-witness case against Cortez, they needed to get their hands on his cell. But when they showed up at the murderer's apartment with a warrant for his phone, Cortez, sprawled on his couch with his half-wit girlfriend, glanced at the writ, laughed, and said, "That's not my number." And it wasn't. In her rush to get the judge to sign off on the warrant, Yasmin had accidentally transposed two of the digits. They were back in his apartment within 2 hours with the proper paper. But by then, Cortez had ditched the object of their desire, and that was the end of that. Cortez still out there doing his thing, while Yasmin, curdled with guilt, had spent the past 5 years banging her head against the wall searching for new ways to bring him in. Dennis got up from the couch and pulled two legal boxes from under a small desk. The last time Billy had seen the Raymond Delpino homicide cartons, they were stuffed with case files, court docs, and notepads, just as they had been on the day she retired and finally snuck them out of the precinct, her overjoyed squad holding the doors for her all the way to the street. But now all they held were invoices, checkbooks, stationery, and stamps. "Do you have any idea how elated I was when I saw her dump all that shit? When was this? A few months ago, I came out of the elevator and there she is, throwing everything down the incinerator chute. Couldn't believe my eyes." Dennis glanced toward the heaped coat by the door. "I was hoping that would be that."
"Look, if it's any consolation, she wasn't the only freak show last night."
"Billy, she's not a freak."
"No, hey, look, you know I didn't mean...
But I have to tell you, Pavlicek, it was like somebody was walking around inside his head with a flashlight."
"Well, that's understandable, given the thing with Banyan."
"You think? Let me tell you something. If it was Curtis Taft who bought the farm instead, are you kidding me?"
"Well, Pavlicek's a different animal."
"The hell he is.
Did Yasmin ever tell you about the day we came on three Nieta Juniors tied up and headshot in an apartment on Southern Boulevard? Scumbags, but still they were kids. You know what Pavlicek did? He took us all out to Jimmy's Bronx River Cafe."
"People change."
"If you say so."
Behind the bedroom door, a broken-voiced Yasmin called for her husband.
"So how's night watch?" Dennis asked, trying to ignore the softly cracked wails.
"You know, quiet, busy, quiet, busy. How's the kids?"
"Good. Yours?"
"Everything's a weapon," Billy said as Yasmin's cries became more full-throated.
"Gotta have girls,"
Dennis grunted as he finally, reluctantly rose for the bedroom.
"The worst thing they do is exclude each other."
Alone now, staring out the window at New Jersey across the river, Billy afforded himself the luxury of remembering Yasmin in the days before that night in Gordon's, when Dennis had inadvertently pulled the plug on all their fun. They got along well enough over the months they were together, doing all the usual out-of-the-house dating stuff, but basically it was about the sex. They both swore to each other that they were the best fucks they'd ever been with, which wasn't saying much when you're both working-class Catholics in your early 20s. And Billy's entire erotic repertoire consisted of sticking it in as fast as he could, withdrawing partially as fast as he could, and repeating if necessary. At the time, Dennis was even more of a sexual bumpkin than either one of them. At his bachelor party, he confessed to Billy, his best man, that he knew Yasmin was no virgin when he proposed, but he loved her too much not to forgive her. Dennis came out of the bedroom looking like a surgeon with bad news. For the 1,000th time in the last 20 years, Billy wondered if he knew about them and just wasn't saying. "Anyways," Billy slowly rose and reached for his jacket.
"You sure you don't want some coffee, a shot of something?"
Dennis stood there, tilting toward the kitchen.
"I'm good."
"You sure?"
"Seriously, I got a book."
Giving up, Dennis finally sat back on the couch.
"I should have brought your shield down to you, you know?"
"No problem," Billy said, backing toward the front door.
"I just didn't want to leave her alone like this, you know?"
"Totally understood."
"I just hope she doesn't start getting crazy about Cortez all over again. You know what I'm saying?"
Dennis staring right through Billy.
"I just could not live with that."
The night was nothing but softballs, the highlight being a report of two women hacking away at each other with hatchets or swords in front of an NYU dorm, which in the end turned out to be just a drunken fight between two Xenas coming out of a costume party and throwing down with their foam axes. By 7:30 in the morning, Billy was on his way home, making it nearly to his exit before he remembered the date and, with a dulling heart, dutifully hit the turnaround and headed back toward the city. Carmen saw two therapists, one of them a stocky ex-nun who, sponsored by Local 1146 of the home and health care workers, bounced around from hospital to hospital in the Bronx like a circuit court judge. She had a makeshift office in the basement of St. Anne's that faintly reeked of the morgue at the opposite end of the hall, an all-too-familiar odor that seemed to underscore Billy's attitude toward his bi-monthly shared sessions, especially when they were scheduled so early in the morning.
"You have to understand," Carmen said. "Victor, when he was a kid, he couldn't even keep his sea monkeys wet, and now he's going to have a child? It'll be dead in a month."
"Jesus," Billy said. "Are you hearing yourself? That doesn't even sound like you."
"Can you elaborate on that, Billy?"
the therapist said, her tone mildly sedating.
"Yeah, Billy, can you elaborate on that?"
"Carm, he's your brother. Why are you always so mad at him?"
"Why is he always so mad at me?"
Billy gave up.
"Okay," the therapist said. "Let's take your question first, Carmen. Why is your brother always so mad at you?"
"He isn't," Billy said.
"Let her talk now." "We went over this a million times," Carmen said. "When he was 12, I had to go live with my father in Atlanta, and he felt like I abandoned him. 1 million times I have said this to you."
"Had to" implies no choice.
"My father was sick. He was remarried. He had a wife,"
Billy said, expecting, then receiving, a warning finger from the therapist.
"His wife was borderline retarded," Carmen said, "just like him."
So a 15-year-old girl had to uproot her entire young life in the Bronx. Mother, brother, school, friends.
"I didn't have any friends."
Except Victor, Billy knew. Carmen always telling him that her younger brother back then was her only friend in the world.
"Like two nerds in a pod," she called them.
"And leave all those she loved in order to be with a man who walked out on her and her family so early in her childhood that she had no memory of what he even looked like?"
"There were other things going on," Carmen said. "I told you that too."
"Yes, you did. But I think maybe the time has come to finally start exploring a few of those other things." The room descended into a tense silence, Billy avoiding his wife's eyes, hoping that she would finally say something, anything, about what he had come to regard as the flight to Atlanta.
"Would you feel more comfortable if your husband left the room?"
Carmen shrugged. And so they all sat there, listening to the squeal of gurneys out in the hall for a full minute or more, until Carmen finally opened her mouth.
"I don't like the Cymbalta you have me on. It makes me too manic. Plus, I think it stops me from having orgasms."
"Jesus, Carmen." Billy blushed, not so much embarrassed for himself as pained for his wife. Afterward, as they walked to the St. Anne's parking lot in silence, each to their own car, Billy remembered asking Carmen once why she hadn't spoken to her therapist about a serious issue involving their kids. Her answer, "because that's personal," had made him laugh so hard his eyes filled with tears. Milton Ramos.
Rose of Lima. Daughters of Jacob. 10 minutes in either institution made him feel like he was breathing air through a pinched straw. Visiting both in the same day left him feeling like a clubbed seal. First that fucking school, some kind of parent career day event that had him standing there rocking from foot to foot like a beetle-browed dummy in front of 24 third graders. The good-looking lay teacher in the back of the room nosed down in paperwork, not even listening or raising her eyes to him as he mumbled his way through the joys of the job. And those questions. "Did you ever kill anybody?"
"No."
"One, but he had it coming."
"Can I see your gun?"
"I'm not carrying one."
"No, you can't see my goddamn gun."
"Did you ever come to my T.O.'s house?"
"Who's your T.O.?"
"Ruben Matos. He lives on Sherman Avenue."
"Yeah, once. At least."
"How much money do you make?"
"Enough to pay tuition here."
"Do you ever get mad at Sophia?"